Future Countries' Best Practices, Chapter 8. The greatest ongoing progress in the world today is the rise of billions of people out of extreme poverty, and that ascent need not be capped by the American and European malaise. Also, technologically driven productivity growth has a way of sneaking up on the world. People take a while to figure out how to put new technologies to their best use, and industries need time to retool their plants and practices around them. Electrification, to take a prominent example, started in the 1890s, but it took 40 years before economists saw the boost in productivity that everyone was waiting for. The personal computer revolution also had a sleeper effect before unleashing productivity growth in the 1990s, which is not surprising to early adopters like me, who lost many an afternoon in the 1980s to installing a mouse or getting a dot matrix printer to do italics. Knowledge about how to get the most out of 21st century technologies may be building up behind dams that will soon burst. Unlike practitioners of the dismal science, technology watchers are adamant that we are entering an age of abundance. Bill Gates has compared the forecast of technological stagnation to the apocryphal prediction in 1913 that war was obsolete. Imagine a world of 9 billion people, write the tech entrepreneur Peter Diamandis and the journalist Stephen Kotler, with clean water, nutritious food, affordable housing, personalized education, top-tier medical care, and non-polluting, ubiquitous energy. Their vision comes not from fantasies out of the Jetsons, but from technologies that are already working, or are very close. Start with the resource that, together with information, is the only way to stave off entropy, and which literally powers everything else in the economy. Energy. As we saw in Chapter 10, fourth-generation nuclear power in the form of small modular reactors can be passively safe, proliferation-proof, waste-free, mass-produced, low-maintenance, indefinitely fueled, and cheaper than coal. Solar panels made with carbon nanotubes can be 100 times as efficient as current photovoltaics, continuing Moore's law for solar energy. Their energy can be stored in liquid metal batteries. In theory, a battery the size of a shipping container could power a neighborhood. One the size of a Walmart could power a small city. A smart grid could collect the energy where and when it's generated and distribute it where and when it's needed. Technology could even breathe new life into fossil fuels. A new design for a zero-emissions gas-fired plant uses the exhaust to drive a turbine directly, rather than wastefully boiling water, and then sequesters the CO2 underground. Digital manufacturing, combining nanotechnology, 3D printing, and rapid prototyping, can produce composites that are stronger and cheaper than steel and concrete, and that can be printed on site for construction of houses and factories in the developing world. Nanofiltration can purify water of pathogens, metals, even salt. High-tech outhouses require no hookups and turn human waste into fertilizer, drinking water, and energy. Precision irrigation and smart grids for water, using cheap sensors and AI and chips, could reduce water usage by a third to a half. Rice that is genetically modified to replace its inefficient C3 photosynthesis pathway with the C4 pathway of corn and sugarcane has a 50% greater yield, uses half the water and far less fertilizer, and tolerates warmer temperatures. Genetically modified algae can pull carbon out of the air and secrete biofuels. Drones can monitor miles of remote pipelines and railways and can deliver medical supplies and spare parts to isolated communities. Robots can take over jobs that humans hate, like mining coal, stocking shelves, and making beds. In the medical realm, a lab on a chip could perform a liquid biopsy and detect any of hundreds of diseases from a drop of blood or saliva. Artificial intelligence, crunching big data on genomes, symptoms, and histories, will diagnose ailments more accurately than the sixth sense of doctors, and will prescribe drugs that mesh with our unique biochemistries. Stem cells could correct autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis, and could populate cadaver organs, organs grown in animals, or 3D printed models with our own tissue. RNA interference could silence pesky genes like the one that regulates the fat insulin receptor. Cancer therapies can be narrow-casted to the unique genetic signature of a tumor instead of poisoning every dividing cell in the body. Global education could be transformed. The world's knowledge has already been made available in encyclopedias, lectures, exercises, and datasets to the billions of people with a smartphone. Individualized instruction can be provided over the web to children in the developing world by volunteers, the Granny Cloud, and to learners anywhere by artificially intelligent tutors. The innovations in the pipeline are not just a list of cool ideas. They fall out of an overarching historical development that has been called the New Renaissance and the Second Machine Age. Whereas the first machine age that emerged out of the Industrial Revolution was driven by energy, the second is driven by the other anti-entropic resource, information. Its revolutionary promise comes from the supercharged use of information to guide every other technology, and from exponential improvement in the technologies of information themselves, like computer power and genomics. The promise of the new machine age also comes from innovations in the process of innovation itself. One is the democratization of platforms for inventions, such as application program interfaces and 3D printers, which can make anyone a high-tech do-it-yourselfer. Another is the rise of techno-philanthropists. Instead of just writing checks for the naming rights to concert halls, they apply their ingenuity, connections, and demand for results to the solution of global problems. A third is the economic empowerment of billions of people through smartphones, online education, and microfinancing. Among the world's bottom billion are 1 million people with a genius-level IQ. Just think what the world would look like if their brain power were put to full use. Will the second machine age kick economies out of their stagnation? It's not certain, because economic growth depends not just on the available technology, but on how well a nation's financial and human capital are deployed to use it. Even if the technologies are put to full use, their benefits may not be registered in standard economic measures. The comedian Pat Paulson once observed, "We live in a country where even the national product is gross." Most economists agree that GNP, or its close relative GDP, is a crude index of economic thriving. It has the virtue of being easy to measure, but because it's just a tally of the money that changes hands in the production of goods and services, it's not the same as the bounty that people enjoy. The problem of consumer surplus, or the paradox of value, has always bedeviled the quantification of prosperity. Chapters 8 and 9, and modern economies are making it more acute. Joel Mocure notes that aggregate statistics like GDP per capita and its derivatives, such as factory productivity, were designed for a steel and wheat economy, not one in which information and data are the most dynamic sector. Many of the new goods and services are expensive to design, but once they work, they can be copied at very low or zero costs. That means they tend to contribute little to measured output, even if their impact on consumer welfare is very large. The dematerialization of life that we examined in Chapter 10, for example, undermines the observation that a 2015 home does not look much different from a 1965 home. The big difference lies in what we don't see, because it's been made obsolete by tablets and smartphones, together with new wonders like streaming video and Skype. In addition to dematerialization, information technology has launched a process of demonetization. Many things that people used to pay for are now essentially free, including classified ads, news, encyclopedias, maps, cameras, long-distance calls, and the overhead of brick-and-mortar retailers. People are enjoying these goods more than ever, but they have vanished from GDP. Human welfare has parted company from GDP in a second way. As modern societies become more humanistic, they devote more of their wealth to forms of human betterment that are not priced in the marketplace. A recent Wall Street Journal article on economic stagnation noted that a growing share of innovative effort has been directed toward cleaner air, safer cars, and drugs for orphan diseases that each affect fewer than 200,000 people nationwide. For that matter, healthcare in general has risen from 7% of research and development in 1960 to 25% in 2007. The financial journalist who wrote the piece noted, almost in sadness, that drugs are symptomatic of the rising value affluent societies place on human life. Health research is displacing R&D that could have gone toward more mundane consumer products. Indeed, the rising value of human life virtually dictates slower growth in regular consumer goods and services, and they constitute the bulk of measured GDP. A natural interpretation is that this trade-off is evidence for the acceleration of progress, not the stagnation of progress. Modern societies, unlike the miserly comedian Jack Benny, have a quick reply to the mugger's demand, your money or your life. A very different threat to human progress is a political movement that seeks to undermine its Enlightenment foundations. The second decade of the 21st century has seen the rise of a counter-Enlightenment movement called populism, more accurately, authoritarian populism. Populism calls for the direct sovereignty of a country's people, usually an ethnic group, sometimes a class, embodied in a strong leader who directly channels their authentic virtue and experience. Authoritarian populism can be seen as a pushback of elements of human nature: tribalism, authoritarianism, demonization, zero-sum thinking, against the Enlightenment institutions that were designed to circumvent them. By focusing on the tribe rather than the individual, it has no place for the protection of minority rights or the promotion of human welfare worldwide. By failing to acknowledge that hard-won knowledge is the key to societal improvement, it denigrates elites and experts, and downplays the marketplace of ideas, including freedom of speech, diversity of opinion, and the fact-checking of self-serving claims. By valorizing a strong leader, populism overlooks the limitations in human nature, and disdains the rule-governed institutions and constitutional checks that constrain the power of flawed human actors. Populism comes in left-wing and right-wing varieties, which share a folk theory of economics as zero-sum competition, between economic classes in the case of the left, between nations or ethnic groups in the case of the right. Problems are seen not as challenges that are inevitable in an indifferent universe, but as the malevolent designs of insidious elites, minorities, or foreigners. As for progress, forget about it. Populism looks backward to an age in which the nation was ethnically homogeneous, orthodox cultural and religious values prevailed, and economies were powered by farming and manufacturing, which produced tangible goods for local consumption and for export. Chapter 23 will probe the intellectual roots of authoritarian populism more deeply. Here I will concentrate on its recent rise and possible future. In 2016, populist parties, mostly on the right, attracted 13.2% of the vote in the preceding European parliamentary elections, up from 5.1% in the 1960s, and entered the governing coalitions of 11 countries, including the leadership of Hungary and Poland. Even when they are not in power, populist parties can press their agendas, notably by catalyzing the 2016 Brexit referendum in which 52% of Britons voted to leave the European Union. And in that year, Donald Trump was elected to the American presidency with an electoral college victory, though with a minority of the popular vote, 46% to Hillary Clinton's 48%. Nothing captures the tribalistic and backward-looking spirit of populism better than Trump's campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again." In writing the chapters on progress, I resisted pressure from readers of earlier drafts to end each one by warning, "But all this progress is threatened if Donald Trump gets his way." Threatened it certainly is. Whether or not 2017 really represents a turning point in history, it's worth reviewing the threats, if only to understand the nature of the progress they threaten. Life and health have been expanded in large part by vaccination and other well-vetted interventions, and among the conspiracy theories that Trump has endorsed is the long-debunked claim that preservatives and vaccines cause autism. The gains have also been secured by broad access to medical care, and he has pushed for legislation that would withdraw health insurance from tens of millions of Americans, a reversal of the trend toward beneficial social spending. Worldwide improvements in wealth have come from a globalized economy powered in large part by international trade. Trump is a protectionist who sees international trade as a zero-sum contest between countries and is committed to tearing up international trade agreements. Growth in wealth will also be driven by technological innovation, education, infrastructure, an increase in the spending power of the lower and middle classes, constraints on cronyism and plutocracy that distort market competition, and regulations on finance that reduce the likelihood of bubbles and crashes. In addition to being hostile to trade, Trump is indifferent to technology and education and an advocate of regressive tax cuts on the wealthy, while appointing corporate and financial tycoons to his cabinet who are indiscriminately hostile to regulation. In capitalizing on concerns about inequality, Trump has demonized immigrants and trade partners while ignoring the major disruptor of lower middle class jobs, technological change. He has also opposed the measures that most successfully mitigate its harms, namely progressive taxation and social spending. The environment has benefited from regulations on air and water pollution that have coexisted with growth in population, GDP, and travel. Trump believes that environmental regulation is economically destructive. Worst of all, he has called climate change a hoax and denounced the withdrawal from the historic Paris Agreement. Safety, too, has been dramatically improved by federal regulations, toward which Trump and his allies are contemptuous. While Trump has cultivated a reputation for law and order, he is viscerally uninterested in evidence-based policy that would distinguish effective crime prevention measures from useless tough talk. The post-war peace has been cemented by trade, democracy, international agreements and organizations, and norms against conquest. Trump has vilified international trade and has threatened to defy international agreements and weaken international organizations. Trump is an admirer of Vladimir Putin, who reversed the democratization of Russia, tried to undermine democracy in the United States and Europe with cyber attacks, helped prosecute the most destructive war of the 21st century in Syria, fomented smaller wars in Ukraine and Georgia, and defied the post-war taboo against conquest in his annexation of Crimea. Several members of Trump's administration secretly colluded with Russia in an effort to lift sanctions against it, undermining a major enforcement mechanism in the outlawry of war. Democracy depends both on explicit constitutional protections, such as freedom of the press, and on shared norms, in particular that political leadership is determined by the rule of law and nonviolent political competition rather than a charismatic leader's will to power. Trump proposed to relax libel laws against journalists, encouraged violence against his critics at his rallies, would not commit to respecting the outcome of the 2016 election if it went against him, tried to discredit the popular vote count that did go against him, threatened to imprison his opponent in the election, and attacked the legitimacy of the judicial system when it challenged his decisions, all hallmarks of a dictator. Globally, the resilience of democracy depends in part on its prestige in the community of nations, and Trump has praised autocrats in Russia, Turkey, the Philippines, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, while denigrating democratic allies such as Germany. The ideals of tolerance, equality, and equal rights took big symbolic hits during his campaign and early administration. Trump demonized Hispanic immigrants, proposed banning Muslim immigration altogether, and tried to impose a partial ban once he was elected, repeatedly demeaned women, tolerated vulgar expressions of racism and sexism at his rallies, accepted support from white supremacist groups and equated them with their opponents, and appointed a strategist and an attorney general who are hostile to the civil rights movement. The ideal of knowledge that one's opinions should be based on justified true beliefs has been mocked by Trump's repetition of ludicrous conspiracy theories, that Obama was born in Kenya, Senator Ted Cruz's father was involved in John F. Kennedy's assassination, thousands of New Jersey Muslims celebrated 9/11, Justice Antonin Scalia was murdered, Obama had his phones tapped, millions of illegal voters cost him the popular vote, and literally dozens of others. The fact-checking site PolitiFact judged that an astonishing 69% of the public statements by Trump they checked were mostly false, false, or pants on fire, their term for outrageous lies from the children's taunt, liar, liar, pants on fire. All politicians bend the truth, and all sometimes lie, since all human beings bend the truth and sometimes lie. But Trump's barefaced assertion of canards that can instantly be debunked, such as that he won the election in a landslide, shows that he sees public discourse not as a means of finding common ground based on objective reality, but as a weapon with which to project dominance and humiliate rivals. Most frighteningly, Trump has pushed back against the norms that have protected the world against the possible existential threat of nuclear war. He questioned the taboo on using nuclear weapons, tweeted about resuming a nuclear arms race, mused about encouraging the proliferation of weapons to additional countries, sought to overturn the agreement that prevents Iran from developing nuclear weapons, and taunted Kim Jong-un about a possible nuclear exchange with North Korea. Worst of all, the chain of command gives an American president enormous discretion over the use of nuclear weapons in a crisis, on the tacit assumption that no president would act rashly on such a grave matter. Yet Trump has a temperament that is notoriously impulsive and vindictive. Not even a congenital optimist can see a pony in this Christmas stocking. But will Donald Trump, and authoritarian populism more generally, really undo a quarter of a millennium of progress? There are reasons not to take poison just yet. If a movement has proceeded for decades or centuries, there are probably systematic forces behind it, and many stakeholders with an interest in its not being precipitously reversed. By the design of the founders, the American presidency is not a rotating monarchy. The president presides over a distributed network of power, denigrated by populists as the deep state, that outlasts individual leaders and carries out the business of government under real-world constraints, which can't easily be erased by populist applause lines or the whims of the man at the top. It includes legislators who have to respond to constituents and lobbyists, judges with reputations of probity to uphold, and executives, bureaucrats, and functionaries who are responsible for the missions of their departments. Trump's authoritarian instincts are subjecting the institutions of American democracy to a stress test, but so far it is pushed back on a number of fronts. Cabinet secretaries have publicly repudiated various quips, tweets, and stink bombs. Courts have struck down unconstitutional measures. Senators and congressmen have defected from his party to vote down destructive legislation. Justice Department and congressional committees are investigating the administration's ties to Russia. An FBI chief has publicly called out Trump's attempt to intimidate him, raising talk about impeachment for obstruction of justice, and his own staff, appalled at what they see, regularly leak compromising facts to the press, all in the first 6 months of the administration. Also boxing a president in are state and local governments, which are closer to the facts on the ground, the governments of other nations which cannot be expected to put a high priority on making America great again, and even most corporations which benefit from peace, prosperity, and stability. Globalization in particular is a tide that is impossible for any ruler to order back. Many of a country's problems are inherently global, including migration, pandemics, terrorism, cybercrime, nuclear proliferation, rogue states, and the environment. Pretending they don't exist is not tenable forever, and they can be solved only through international cooperation. Nor can the benefits of globalization, more affordable goods, larger markets for exports, the reduction in global poverty be denied indefinitely. And with the internet and inexpensive travel, there will be no stopping the flow of people and ideas, especially, as we will see, among younger people. As for the battle against truth and fact, over the long run, they have a built-in advantage. When you stop believing in them, they don't go away. The deeper question is whether the rise of populist movements, whatever damage they do in the short term, represents the shape of things to come. Whether, as a recent Boston Globe editorial lamented/gloated, the Enlightenment had a good run. Do the events around 2016 really imply that the world is headed back to the Middle Ages? As with climate change skeptics who claim to be vindicated by a nippy morning, it's easy to overinterpret recent events. For one thing, the latest elections are not referenda on the Enlightenment. In the American political duopoly, any Republican candidate starts from a partisan floor of at least 45% of the votes in a two-way race, and Trump was defeated in the popular vote 46-48%, while benefiting from electoral shenanigans and from campaigning misjudgments on Clinton's part. And Barack Obama, who in his farewell speech actually credited the Enlightenment for the essential spirit of this country, left office with an approval rating of 58%, above average for departing presidents. Trump entered office with a rating of 40%, the lowest ever for an incoming president, and during his first 7 months it sank to 34%, barely more than half of the average rating of the 9 previous presidents at the same point in their terms. European elections, too, are not depth soundings for a commitment to cosmopolitan humanism, but reactions to a bundle of emotionally charged issues of the day. These included, recently, the euro currency, which arouses skepticism among many economists, intrusive regulation from Brussels, and pressure to accept large numbers of refugees from the Middle East, just when fears of Islamic terrorism, however disproportionate to the risk, were being stoked by horrific attacks. Even then, populist parties have attracted only 13% of the votes in recent years, and they have lost seats in as many national legislatures as they have gained them in. In the year following the Trump and Brexit shocks, right-wing populism was repudiated in elections in the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, and France, where the new president, Emmanuel Macron, proclaimed that Europe was waiting for us to defend the spirit of the Enlightenment, threatened in so many places. But far more important than the political events of the mid-2010s are the social and economic trends that have fostered authoritarian populism, and more to the point of this chapter, that may foretell its future. Beneficial historical developments often create losers together with the winners, and the apparent economic losers of globalization, namely the lower classes of rich countries, are often said to be the supporters of authoritarian populism. For economic determinists, this is enough to explain the rise of the movement. But analysts have sifted through the election results like investigators inspecting the wreckage at the site of a plane crash, and we now know that the economic explanation is wrong. In the American election, voters in the two lowest income brackets voted for Clinton 52-42, as did those who identified the economy as the most important issue. A majority of voters in the four highest income brackets voted for Trump, and Trump voters singled out immigration and terrorism, not the economy, as the most important issues. The twisted metal has turned up more promising clues. An article by the statistician Nate Silver began, "Sometimes statistical analysis is tricky, and sometimes a finding just jumps off the page." That finding jumped right off the page and into the article's headline, "Education, Not Income, Predicted Who Would Vote for Trump." Why should education have mattered so much? Two uninteresting explanations are that the highly educated happen to affiliate with the liberal political tribe, and that education may be a better long-term predictor of economic security than current income. A more interesting explanation is that education exposes people in young adulthood to other races and cultures in a way that makes it harder to demonize them. Most interesting of all is the likelihood that education, when it does what it is supposed to do, instills a respect for vetted fact and reasoned argument, and so inoculates people against conspiracy theories, reasoning by anecdote, and emotional demagoguery. In another page jumper, Silver found that the regional map of Trump support did not overlap particularly well with the maps of unemployment, religion, gun ownership, or the proportion of immigrants. But it did align with the map of Google searches for the word nigger, which Seth Stevens Davidowitz has shown is a reliable indicator of racism, Chapter 15. This doesn't mean that most Trump supporters are racists, but overt racism shades into resentment and distrust, and the overlap suggests that the regions of the country that gave Trump his Electoral College victory are those with the most resistance to the decades-long process of integration and the promotion of minority interests, particularly racial preferences, which they see as reverse discrimination against them. Among the exit poll questions that probed general attitudes, the most consistent predictor of Trump support was pessimism. 69% of Trump supporters felt that the direction of the country was seriously off track, and they were similarly jaundiced about the workings of the federal government and the lives of the next generation of Americans. Across the pond, the political scientists Ronald Engelhardt and Pippa Norris spotted similar patterns in their analysis of 268 political parties in 31 European countries. Economic issues, they found, have been playing a smaller role in party manifestos for decades, and non-economic issues a larger role. The same was true of the distribution of voters. Support for populist parties is strongest not from manual workers, but from the petty bourgeoisie, self-employed tradesmen and the owners of small businesses, followed by foremen and technicians. Populist voters are older, more religious, more rural, less educated, and more likely to be male and members of the ethnic majority. They embrace authoritarian values, place themselves on the right of the political spectrum, and dislike immigration and global and national governance. Brexit voters, too, were older, more rural, and less educated than those who voted to remain. 66% of high school graduates voted to leave, but only 29% of degree holders did. Engelhardt and Norris concluded that supporters of authoritarian populism are the losers not so much of economic competition as cultural competition. Voters who are male, religious, less educated, and in the ethnic majority feel that they have become strangers from the predominant values in their own country, left behind by progressive tides of cultural change that they do not share. The silent revolution launched in the 1970s seems to have spawned a resentful counter-revolutionary backlash today. Paul Taylor, a political analyst at the Pew Research Center, singled out the same countercurrent in American polling results. The overall drift is toward more liberal views on a range of issues, but that doesn't mean the whole country is buying in. Though the source of the populist backlash may be found in currents of modernity that have been engulfing the world for some time, globalization, racial diversity, women's empowerment, secularism, urbanization, education, its electoral success in a particular country depends on whether a leader materializes who can channel that resentment. Neighboring countries with comparable cultures can thus differ in the degree to which populism gains traction. Hungary more than the Czech Republic, Norway more than Sweden, Poland more than Romania, Austria more than Germany, France more than Spain, and the United States more than Canada. In 2016, Spain, Canada, and Portugal had no populist party legislators at all. How will the tension play out between the liberal, cosmopolitan, enlightenment humanism that has been sweeping the world for decades and the regressive, authoritarian, tribal populism pushing back? The major long-term forces that have carried liberalism along—mobility, connectivity, education, urbanization—are not likely to go into reverse, and neither is the pressure for equality from women and ethnic minorities. All of these portents, to be sure, are conjectural. But one is as certain as the first half of the idiom, death and taxes. Populism is an old man's movement. As Figure 20-1 shows, Support for all three of its recrudescences, Trump, Brexit, and European populist parties, falls off dramatically with year of birth. The alt-right movement, which overlaps with populism, has a youngish membership, but for all its notoriety, it is an electoral non-entity, numbering perhaps 50,000 people or 0.02% of the American population. The age roll-off isn't surprising, since we saw in Chapter 15 that in the 20th century, every birth cohort has been more tolerant and liberal than the one that came before. At the same time that all the cohorts have drifted liberal-ward. This raises the possibility that as the silent generation and older baby boomers shuffle off this mortal coil, they will take authoritarian populism with them. Of course, the cohorts of the present say nothing about the politics of the future if people change their values as they age. Perhaps if you are a populist at 25, you have no heart, and if you are not a populist at 45, you have no brain, to adapt a meme that has been said about liberals, socialists, communists, leftists, Republicans, Democrats, and revolutionists, and that has been attributed to various quotation magnates, including Victor Hugo, Benjamin Disraeli, George Bernard Shaw, Georges Clemenceau, Winston Churchill, and Bob Dylan. But whoever said it, probably the 19th-century jurist Anselm Botbee, who in turn attributed it to Edmund Burke, and regardless of which belief system it's supposed to apply to, the claim about life cycle effects on political orientation is false. As we saw in Chapter 15, people carry their emancipative values with them as they age, rather than sliding into illiberalism. And a recent analysis of 20th-century American voters by the political scientists Yair Gitza and Andrew Gelman has shown that Americans do not consistently vote for more conservative presidents as they age. Their voting preferences are shaped by their cumulative experience of the popularity of presidents over their lifespans, with a peak of influence in the 14 to 24-year-old window. The young voters who reject populism today are unlikely to embrace it tomorrow. How might one counter the populist threat to Enlightenment values? Economic insecurity is not the driver, so the strategies of reducing income inequality and of talking to laid-off steel workers and trying to feel their pain, however praiseworthy, will probably be ineffective. Cultural backlash does seem to be a driver, so avoiding needlessly polarizing rhetoric, symbolism, and identity politics might help to recruit, or at least not repel, voters who are not sure which team they belong to. More on this in Chapter 21. Since populist movements have achieved an influence beyond their numbers, fixing electoral irregularities such as gerrymandering and forms of disproportionate representation which overweight rural areas, such as the U.S. Electoral College, would help. So would journalistic coverage that tied candidates' reputations to their record of accuracy and coherence rather than to trivial gaffes and scandals. Part of the problem, over the long term, will dissipate with urbanization. You can't keep them down on the farm. And part will dissipate with demographics. As has been said about science, sometimes society advances funeral by funeral. Still, a puzzle in the rise of authoritarian populism is why a shocking proportion of the sectors of the population whose interests were most endangered by the outcome of the elections, such as younger Britons with Brexit, and African Americans, Latinos, and American millennials with Trump, stayed home on election day. This brings us back to a major theme of this book, and to my own small prescription for strengthening the current of Enlightenment humanism against the latest counter-Enlightenment backlash. I believe that the media and intelligentsia were complicit in populists' depiction of modern Western nations as so unjust and dysfunctional that nothing short of a radical lurch could improve them. "Charge the cockpit or you die," shrieked a conservative essayist, comparing the country to the hijacked flight on 9/11 that was brought down by a passenger mutiny. "I'd rather see the empire burned to the ground under Trump, opening up at least the possibility of radical change, than cruise on autopilot under Clinton," flamed a left-wing advocate of the politics of arson. Even moderate editorialists in mainstream newspapers commonly depict the country as a hellhole of racism, inequality, terrorism, social pathology, and failing institutions. The problem with dystopian rhetoric is that if people believe that the country is a flaming dumpster, they will be receptive to the perennial appeal of demagogues. What do you have to lose? If the media and intellectuals instead put events into statistical and historical context, they could help answer that question. Radical regimes from Nazi Germany and Maoist China to contemporary Venezuela and Turkey show that people have a tremendous amount to lose when charismatic authoritarians responding to a crisis trample over democratic norms and institutions and command their countries by the force of their personalities. A liberal democracy is a precious achievement. Until the Messiah comes, it will always have problems, but it's better to solve those problems than to start a conflagration and hope that something better arises from the ashes and bones. By failing to take note of the gifts of modernity, social critics poison voters against responsible custodians and incremental reformers who can consolidate the tremendous progress we have enjoyed and strengthen the conditions that will bring us more. The challenge in making the case for modernity is that when one's nose is inches from the news, optimism can seem naive or, in the pundit's favorite new cliché about elites, out of touch. Yet in a world outside of hero myths, the only kind of progress we can have is a kind that is easy to miss while we are living through it. As the philosopher Isaiah Berlin pointed out, the ideal of a perfectly just, equal, free, healthy, and harmonious society, which liberal democracies never measure up to, is a dangerous fantasy. People are not clones, so what satisfies one will frustrate another, and the only way they can end up equal is if they are treated unequally. Moreover, among the perquisites of freedom is the freedom of people to screw up their own lives. Liberal democracies can make progress, but only against a constant backdrop of messy compromise and constant reform. The children have obtained what their parents and grandparents longed for: greater freedom, greater material welfare, a juster society. But the old ills are forgotten, and the children face new problems, brought about by the very solutions of the old ones, and these, even if they can in turn be solved, generate new situations, and with them new requirements, and so on, forever, and unpredictably. Such is the nature of progress. Pulling us forward are ingenuity, sympathy, and benign institutions. Pushing us back are the darker sides of human nature and the second law of thermodynamics. Kevin Kelly explains how this dialectic can nonetheless result in forward motion. Ever since the Enlightenment and the invention of science, we've managed to create a tiny bit more than we've destroyed each year. But that few percent positive difference is compounded over decades into what we might call civilization. Progress is a self-cloaking action seen only in retrospect, which is why I tell people that my great optimism of the future is rooted in history. We don't have a catchy name for a constructive agenda that reconciles long-term gains with short-term setbacks, historical currents with human agency. Optimism is not quite right, because a belief that things will always get better is no more rational than the belief that things will always get worse. Kelly offers protopia, the pro from progress, and process. Others have suggested pessimistic hopefulness, optorealism, and radical incrementalism. My favorite comes from Hans Rosling, who, when asked whether he was an optimist, replied, "I am not an optimist. I'm a very serious possibilist." Part 3. Reason, Science, and Humanism. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men, who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences, are usually slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority, who hear voices in the air, are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. I am sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. John Maynard Keynes. Ideas matter. Homo sapiens is a species that lives by its wits, concocting and pooling notions of how the world works and how its members can best lead their lives. There can be no better proof of the power of ideas than the ironic influence of the political philosopher who most insisted on the power of vested interests, the man who wrote that the ruling ideas of each age have ever been the ideas of its ruling class. Karl Marx possessed no wealth and commanded no army, but the ideas he scribbled in the reading room of the British Museum shaped the course of the 20th century and beyond, wrenching the lives of billions. This part of the book wraps up my defense of the ideas of the Enlightenment. Part 1 outlined those ideas. Part 2 showed they work. Now it's time to defend them against some surprising enemies, not just angry populists and religious fundamentalists, but factions of mainstream intellectual culture. It may sound quixotic to offer a defense of the Enlightenment against professors, critics, pundits, and their readers, because if they were asked about these ideals point blank, few would disavow them. But intellectuals' commitment to those ideals is squirrely. The hearts of many of them lie elsewhere, and few are willing to proffer a positive defense. Enlightenment ideals, thus unchampioned, fade into the background as a bland default and become a catch basin for every unsolved societal problem, of which there will always be many. Illiberal ideas like authoritarianism, tribalism, and magical thinking easily get the blood pumping and have no shortage of champions. It's hardly a fair fight. Though I hope Enlightenment ideals will become more deeply entrenched in the public at large, fundamentalists, angry populists, and all, I claim no competence in the dark arts of mass persuasion, popular mobilization, or viral memes. Put follower arguments directed at people who care about arguments. These arguments can matter because practical men and women and madmen in authority are affected, directly or indirectly, by the world of ideas. They go to university. They read intellectual magazines, if only in dentists' waiting rooms. They watch talking heads on Sunday morning news shows. They are briefed by staff members who subscribe to highbrow papers and watch TED Talks. They frequent internet discussion forums that are enlightened or endarkened by the reading habits of the more literate contributors. I like to think that some good might come to the world if more of the ideas that trickle into these tributaries embodied the Enlightenment ideals of reason, science, and humanism. Chapter 21. Reason. Opposing reason is by definition unreasonable, but that hasn't stopped a slew of irrationalists from favoring the heart over the head, the limbic system over the cortex, Blinking over thinking, McCoy over Spock. There was the romantic movement of the counter-enlightenment captured in Johann Herder's avowal, "I am not here to think, but to be, feel, live." There's the common veneration, not just by the religious, of faith, namely believing something without a good reason. There's the postmodernist credo that reason is a pretext to exert power, reality is socially constructed, and all statements are trapped in a web of self-reference and collapse into paradox. Even members of my own tribe of cognitive psychologists often claim to have refuted what they take to be the Enlightenment belief that humans are rational agents and hence to have undermined the centrality of reason itself. The implication is that it is futile even to try to make the world a more rational place. But all these positions have a fatal flaw. They refute themselves. They deny that there can be a reason for believing those very positions. As soon as their defenders open their mouths to begin their defense, they have lost the argument, because in that very act they are tacitly committed to persuasion, to adducing reasons for what they are about to argue, which, they insist, ought to be accepted by their listeners according to standards of rationality that both accept. Otherwise, they are wasting their breath and might as well try to convert their audience by bribery or violence. In The Last Word, the philosopher Thomas Nagel drives home the point that subjectivity and relativism regarding logic and reality are incoherent because one can't criticize something with nothing. The claim, everything is subjective, must be nonsense, for it would itself have to be either subjective or objective. But it can't be objective, since in that case it would be false if true, and it can't be subjective because then it would not rule out any objective claim, including the claim that it is objectively false. There may be some subjectivists, perhaps styling themselves as pragmatists, who present subjectivism as applying even to itself. But then it does not call for a reply, since it is just a report of what the subjectivist finds it agreeable to say. If he also invites us to join him, we need not offer any reason for declining, since he has offered us no reason to accept. Nagel calls this line of thinking Cartesian because it resembles Descartes' argument, I think, therefore I am. Just as the very fact that one is wondering whether one exists demonstrates that one exists, the very fact that one is appealing to reasons demonstrates that reason exists. It may also be called a transcendental argument, one that invokes the necessary preconditions for doing what it is doing, namely making an argument. In a way, it goes back to the ancient liar's paradox, featuring the Cretan who says, all Cretans are liars. Whatever you call the argument, it would be a mistake to interpret it as justifying a belief or a faith in reason, which Nagel calls one thought too many. We don't believe in reason, we use reason, just as we don't program our computers to have a CPU. A program is a sequence of operations made available by the CPU. Though reason is prior to everything else and needn't, indeed cannot, be justified on first principles, once we start engaging in it, we can stoke our confidence that the particular kinds of reasoning we are engaging in are sound by noting their internal coherence and their fit with reality. Life is not a dream in which disconnected experiences appear in bewildering succession, and the application of reason to the world validates itself by granting us the ability to bend the world to our will, from curing infections to sending a man to the moon. Despite its provenance in abstract philosophy, the Cartesian argument is not an exercise in logic chopping. From the most recondite deconstructionist to the most anti-intellectual purveyor of conspiracy theories and alternative facts, everyone recognizes the power of responses like, why should I believe you, or prove it, or you're full of crap. Few would reply, that's right, there's no reason to believe me, or yes, I'm lying right now, or I agree, what I'm saying is bullshit. It's in the very nature of argument that people stake a claim to being right. As soon as they do, they have committed themselves to reason, and the listeners they are trying to convince can hold their feet to the fire of coherence and accuracy. By now many people have become aware of the research in cognitive psychology on human irrationality, explained in bestsellers like Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow and Dan Ariely's Predictably Irrational. I've alluded to these cognitive infirmities in earlier chapters, the way we estimate probability from available anecdotes, project stereotypes onto individuals, seek confirming and ignore disconfirming evidence, dread harms and losses, and reason from teleology and voodoo resemblance rather than mechanical cause and effect. But as important as these discoveries are, it's a mistake to see them as refuting some Enlightenment tenet that humans are rational actors, or is licensing the fatalistic conclusion that we might as well give up on reasoned persuasion and fight demagoguery with demagoguery. To begin with, no Enlightenment thinker ever claimed that humans were consistently rational. Certainly not the uber-rational Kant, who wrote that, from the crooked timber of humanity, no truly straight thing can be made. Nor Spinoza, Hume, Smith, or the encyclopedists, who were cognitive and social psychologists ahead of their time. What they argued was that we ought to be rational by learning to repress the fallacies and dogmas that so readily seduce us, and that we can be rational collectively, if not individually, by implementing institutions and adhering to norms that constrain our faculties, including free speech, logical analysis, and empirical testing. And if you disagree, then why should we accept your claim that humans are incapable of rationality? Often the cynicism about reason is justified with a crude version of evolutionary psychology, not one endorsed by evolutionary psychologists, in which humans think with their amygdalas, reacting instinctively to the slightest rustle in the grass which may portend a crouching tiger. But real evolutionary psychology treats humans differently, not as two-legged antelopes, but as the species that outsmarts antelopes. We are a cognitive species that depends on explanations of the world. Since the world is the way it is, regardless of what people believe about it, there is a strong selection pressure for an ability to develop explanations that are true. Reasoning thus has deep evolutionary roots. The citizen scientist Louis Liebenberg has studied the San hunter-gatherers of the Kalahari Desert, the Bushmen, one of the world's most ancient cultures. They engage in the oldest form of the chase, persistence hunting, in which humans, with their unique ability to dump heat through sweat-slicked skin, pursue a furry mammal in the midday sun until it collapses of heat stroke. Since most mammals are swifter than humans and dart out of sight as soon as they are spotted, persistence hunters track them by their spore, which means inferring the animal's species, sex, age, and level of fatigue, and thus its likely direction of flight, from the hoof prints, bent stems, and displaced pebbles it leaves behind. The San do not just engage in inference, deducing, for example, that agile springboks tread deeply with pointed hooves to get a good grip, whereas heavy kudus tread flat-footed to support their weight. They also engage in reasoning, articulating the logic behind their inferences to persuade their companions or be persuaded in their turn. Liebenberg observes that Kalahari trackers don't accept arguments from authority. A young tracker can challenge the majority opinion of his elders, and if his interpretation of the evidence is convincing, he can bring them around, increasing the group's accuracy. And if you're still tempted to excuse modern dogma and superstition by saying that it's only human, consider Liebenberg's account of scientific skepticism among the San. Three trackers, Nate, Uasi, and Borok Au of Lone Tree in the central Kalahari, told me that the monotonous lark, Mirafra passerina, only sings after it has rained because it is happy that it rained. One tracker, Borok Au, told me that when the bird sings, it dries out the soil, making the roots good to eat. Afterwards, Nate and Wasi told me that Borok Au was wrong. It is not the bird that dries out the soil, it is the sun that dries out the soil. The bird is only telling them that the soil will dry out in the coming months, and that it is the time of the year when the roots are good to eat. Namka, a tracker from Biri in the central Kalahari, Botswana, told me the myth of how the sun is like an eland, which crosses the sky and is then killed by people who live in the west. The red glow in the sky when the sun goes down is the blood of the eland. After they have eaten it, they throw the shoulder blade across the sky back to the east, where it falls into a pool and grows into a new sun. Sometimes, it is said, you can hear the swishing noise of the shoulder blade flying through the air. After telling me the story in great detail, he told me that he thinks that the old people lied because he has never seen the shoulder blade fly through the sky or heard the swishing noise. Of course, none of this contradicts the discovery that humans are vulnerable to illusions and fallacies. Our brains are limited in their capacity to process information and evolved in a world without science, scholarship, and other forms of fact-checking. But reality is a mighty selection pressure. So a species that lives by ideas must have evolved with an ability to prefer correct ones. The challenge for us today is to design an informational environment in which that ability prevails over the ones that lead us into folly. The first step is to pinpoint why an otherwise intelligent species is so easily led into folly. The 21st century, an age of unprecedented access to knowledge, has also seen maelstroms of irrationality, including the denial of evolution, vaccine safety, and anthropogenic climate change, and the promulgation of conspiracy theories from 9/11 to the size of Donald Trump's popular vote. Fans of rationality are desperate to understand the paradox,